tonight. I have the pleasure of introducing yet again.
Again
and yet again, Michael Rinaldini, Taoist priest and founder of American Dragon Gate Lineage, to speak about the value of spiritual retreats. Michael is a nationally certified Qigong teacher, a Taoist priest, and director of the Qigong and Taoist Training Center, with a website name that you can look up at your convenience. But tonight he's going to tell us about his long history of doing retreats in a number of different spiritual traditions. A very interesting topic, and we're delighted to have him back with us. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you. So you mentioned the Kriya Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing on my list.
Really? Perfect.
It may have been my very, well, so it's retreats. So some of it is sort of my, like a quick review of some of the retreats that I've been on. And then sort of kind of in and out of this idea of, well, what's the benefit? What's the purpose? What's the value of going on retreats? You know, that will be answered here and there and here and there, and maybe get some feedback too. But the first thing that I prepared for this was sort of like a rough list. A rough list of the retreats that I've gone on. And it's, you know, well, you'll see some of it is sort of, I can't name every retreat I've been on before. You know, I just don't remember every single one. I know general groups of retreats that I've been on, but I clearly, you know, the ones that are down here that are very clear. And I think that the first official retreat that I ever went on was a Kriya Yoga retreat. So, and I think the year was 1973 when I moved around. I went away to college, and I did a lot of traveling when my first 2 years of college, from New York to Oklahoma was where I went first to college. I did a lot of exploring and crazy stuff during those years. I don't think any official... it wasn't a retreat, but I had a lot of important experiences during that time. But then I moved to Florida, and I got involved with practicing yoga and the local Hindu group, and during that time I got exposed to Kriya Yoga. And so me and a carload of a few people, we drove to Georgia for this retreat. And so that was my first real retreat. And going away, I don't remember if it was a weekend or a week, but I met Roy Eugene Davis there, who was one of the main disciples of Yogananda. But I was with that other guy who's still around, you know, like everyone ages, and now he aged along with the rest of us. He was the bhakti guy. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No, I'm not sure.
And I just saw a picture of him recently, like I think in Common Ground. But, so he was like, well, I don't want to get too much into what happened on these retreats, because we can just talk, you know, too much on an individual one. But so that was the beginning of maybe my first formal retreat, where I went away to do something for a short time, and then so that begins to be like a working definition of, well, how do you define what a retreat is? Because I'm really using it. You're going to see I'm using it in a very broad way. It's not just going off for the weekend or a week to a place and then it's over and you come back home. That's part of my definition, which is, so this fits that basic definition of what a retreat is. Then I also include in my definition a longer stay at a place, but I did come home. I didn't stay there. So so this was after going to India and coming back, I went to a Vedanta monastery in Michigan for 6 months. So now I call that a retreat. I didn't think of that as a retreat at the time. So it's sort of like a definition that goes back and forth in time. So that, in my mind now, 40 years later, was a retreat. It was meant to be a lifelong decision to stay there. But now it falls into my category of a six-month retreat. Then began a six-year period of going out in and out of different Catholic monasteries. So those were now what I call retreats. Because some of them were going away for 2 weeks. I went away for 3 months or a month. You know, all of these different variations. So during that six-year period at the end of the 70s, I was on retreat for a year, including that 6 months at the Vedanta place, for a year in and out of different monasteries. And if I had stayed in one of them, they wouldn't be retreats, and I wouldn't be here, probably. I'd be there, wherever that was. So, and then I remembered, well, I remember something that I read from Thomas Merton in one of his books. He said, he didn't use the word retreat, he may, but he basically said everybody needs, especially when they're in their 20s, it could be earlier, but everyone should, when you're still in that formation part of your life, you haven't hooked into the job career and the marriage thing and, you know, the long-term thing that is hard to break away from. He said, before you get into that solid part of who you are, you should go away for an extended time in a monastery or in a retreat somewhere. Because he was very, you know, probably a lot of you know about Thomas Merton. He was in a big struggle all the time of not being very happy to be in one place. And he was always, you know, later on he got to have all this permission to do other things. But he wasn't a happy monk. And it came out in his writings. And I met, I kind of followed in some of his path. So I met some of his brothers in different monasteries and got pretty close to some of them. So he said, as a young person, you should go away on retreat. You know, get an experience of this deep living before you get involved with other stuff, because it's very hard to go back to. It's very hard to go do that. You can get away for a short time, but it's hard to spend 6 months or a couple of years in a real concentrated, you know, spiritual practice. Then I moved to the Boston area for another six-year period, and I was doing a lot of retreats. I got involved with the local Vipassana group, and in addition to like weekly or a couple of times a week going there, they had frequent weekend retreats or day-long. So I did a lot of them. That's why I mean I can't tell you how many retreats I've actually done, because I did a lot during that six-year period. Then, when I left Massachusetts, Boston, and I came here to first in the Berkeley area in the end of the 80s, like 1986 or 87, and I was involved with other stuff. Then when I kind of moved up here to this area, which I've been in this area close to 20 years, then I started doing retreats again, but it was, they were like, because I had went through a change. I was leaving my Tibetan Buddhist practice, so I did some retreats locally in this area. Then I started doing Qigong training. So some of these were trainings that I went away to, and some of them were, like one group teacher that I got involved with is Luke Chan, and to become a teacher in his practice, you had to do 2 6-day retreats a year apart. So those were residential place. One was in LA, and I forget where the first one was. But those were the beginning of my Qigong-oriented retreats. And but they were like very learning. They were much different from my earlier retreats, where there was a real focus on inner development and cultivation and, you know, meditation. These were like learning and practicing, you know, Qigong. So it was a different kind of experience of a retreat. Then I did a lot of other trainings, going away for a weekend, training to learn a particular practice with different teachers around the country. So, and then my trips to China, like, well, was that a retreat or was that just a trip to China to study and practice? So I don't know, but they kind of like had a special focus, and so it becomes like a learning retreat, you know, as well as international travel. Then I have been, since 2000, the majority of the retreats that I've been on are ones that I've led, but they count as retreats because I was there, you know, and many times I work out the agenda and all of this stuff, and then I'm at the beginning of the retreat and I'm looking at it and I'm saying, this looks like a good retreat, I'm going to do it. you get separate from it after a while. And then you just go with it, and you're on the retreat, and like, oh, I have to do this now because the schedule says to do this. Forget, I'm the one that's, you know, calling the shots, but I have to follow the schedule because that's what the schedule is. That's what you do on a retreat. So for a while I was doing, and I still do, but not as much, these one-day retreats where I teach my class at the Gazad building through the community center by the Brookhaven School. One-day retreats, 3-hour retreats. Mary's been on a lot of these. I don't know if I've ever done a 1-hour retreat, because that would just be a class. But sometimes I have a 3-hour mini retreat where we focus on a particular thing. And sometimes we've done retreats from like 11 until 6 at night or 8 in the evening.
We did one at midnight.
Well, yeah, we started late. We did a midnight. We got together around 6, yeah, and we went to midnight. So that was nice. Then 3 years ago I started getting a little bit more serious with these retreats. And a couple of students said, why don't you let's try to find a place where we can go away and do residential retreats. So we did 2 years at the Gold Ridge Sangha at their center, where it was a full weekend, and Friday to Sunday afternoon. We did that for 2 years, and then last September, we went to the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center for a weekend. And then now I've connected with the CYO Camp Retreat Center in Occidental. That place is right over there, right around the corner, and it's a great place. I wish I knew about it earlier. And so now I'm scheduled to, now I'm doing 2 of these weekend retreats a year, and the first one's coming up in May, and then the other one is in September. And then I just turned 60 yesterday.
Congratulations.
And thank you.
Happy birthday.
But last year it sparked like something in me that I felt like I started to prepare for 60, because in Taoism, 60 years is very significant. So last year I started preparing for it by going to a retreat back, you know, for myself again, because I haven't been doing all these retreats that involved other people, or retreats where I have to go and learn a lot of stuff. So I decided I needed to start another tradition for myself. So last January of 2009, I was looking all over, you know, things have to be affordable. But I was going to go first up to the Portland area to a Zen center, and then I was looking around, and then I remembered we got these guys in our backyard in Big Sur, the new Kamaldoli Hermitage. And because, you know, my Catholic monastic background, I kind of knew very much. They were one of the few monasteries in the country that I didn't go to in my searching years. And they have a big retreat program. And so I went down there for 10, 11 days. And they kind of leave you alone, you know. You do whatever you want to do. And it was a really nice experience. And so this year, I didn't go back. I knew it wasn't going to be another 10-day thing for me. This January, I went to the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center as an individual person on retreat there. And during that week when it just rained every day really hard. So it was a rain retreat. So that kind of catches up. Oh, and then the other kind of retreat, so that gives you a general idea of what I'm calling retreats. It's, you know, big category, little categories. But one of my favorite categories of what I call a retreat is an all-night meditation retreat. Like, I bet everyone here has excuses why, like, you don't do retreats, you know, often. Or, you know, it's the money, you know, the retreat you really want to do is in New York or Maine, or, you know, it's in India or China, or you just can't get the time, or you're not disciplined enough to do it. So, I have students, my Qigong and priest students all over the country, and so we can't get together very often to practice as a group. And also, like, I'm, you know, like, sometimes really want to just get away, do a retreat, but, you know, I don't have the money or I don't really have a place I want to go to, but I want to have a little chunk of time for a retreat. So I started this little practice called all-night retreat. So, and I usually do it on a Saturday. Well, I only do it on a Saturday. So I have a normal weekend until Saturday night, and I say goodbye to my family around between 11 and 12. You know, they're getting ready to go to bed or whatever, and I have my little meditation room, and I have my books, and I bring my puer tea, and I go to my room out there, and I got, you know, if it's in the winter, I have my heaters and everything, and I go to that room, and I'm there. And I usually call it at 12 o'clock, 12 midnight to 6 a.m. And so then I just stay up all night, and I do maybe some reading, I maybe do some writing. I usually have more books there than I need. And I have a collection of my Taoist scriptures that I read from, recite from. And I do a lot of meditation. If I'm restless or if I need to, I go outside in my yard to do some Qigong under the stars. But I'm mainly there kind of meditating, little reading here and there. You know, I may have something I need to work out on or to write or to develop. And so that's, you know, a special time. And then 6 o'clock, I go back in the house and I kind of catch a couple hours of sleep, and then I wake up, you know, like by 9 or 10 o'clock, and it's the week, you know, Sunday then. And I kind of like, it's like stealing a retreat, you know? All I had to do is sleep a little later, you know, after six, and I squeezed in a retreat. So that's one of my favorite kind of things to do. I'm always encouraging my students, and that, you know, they can't always do it the same time as I do, but they squeezed it in somewhere else. So it's a nice way to get a extra 6 hours. And that time of the night, it's a special, spooky, kind of mysterious time. So that's another definition of what I call retreat now. So now I want to... Any questions so far? Any questions about... So that's... Kind of to just think about the value of all of that. I mean, like, I wouldn't be the person I am now if I didn't do all of those retreats. Maybe I could have admitted 10 of them and still be the same person. But if I admitted all of those kind of retreats, you know, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. Because each one of those retreats was what, you know, what people call life confirming or something like that, where they kind of like, you're only doing them for a reason. And it's to continue what you're doing, but giving yourself a chance to do it even more. You know, sometimes you gotta, part of the reasons for a retreat is to supplement or add on some knowledge stuff. But probably the core reason for doing a retreat is this inner knowledge. I mean, there may be a teacher involved, but what will become really valuable to you is the inner knowledge of that, how that resonates with you. So I found out, well, I didn't find out, but I knew many other people are doing retreats. And that's why I said to Damara, like, get this book for when I do my talk here, because some other people may like to get this book too. And I think I brought this book with me when I went on that 10-day retreat last year, and I went through it then. Or this inspired me, I forget. But this is, so who's read the book or familiar? So,
who's the author?
Jane Dubise. She's a Zen teacher up in Cambridge. And she decided, well, the funny story is she starts her, she's already, she's not a Zen teacher yet, but she's a Zen student. And she decides she needs to go on a real serious retreat. She needs to meet a really serious Zen, or actually she was a Tibetan practitioner at that point. So she needs to meet a real master. So she goes to Tibet, you know, does the thing to get there. And she has a particular person in mind. So just like the movie, The Razor's Edge, she has to go all the way up those trails and find... There's this teacher, and she knocks on the door, and this Tibetan woman says, what answers the door, and she says, is Lama so-and-so here? You know, I come to train with him. And she says, oh, he's not here. He's in New York. And so she realizes a lot of stuff right there in a moment. I think she still hung out with some other lamas for a while. But then she came back, and it doesn't even seem like she then reconnected with this teacher in New York. But when she came back, she realized, you know, first of all, she didn't need to do that. She, you know, it's all of this inner stuff. But she realized she needs to do a retreat. And so here she is living in Cambridge. Since I had already been to the Himalayas and back again, it occurred to me that I didn't have to be in an exotic locale like Tibet or Korea for such an undertaking. So she made plans to do a 100-day solo Zen retreat in the woods of New England with no idea of what would happen or even if I would make it through the first week. At a bare minimum, I would find out the limitations of my mind. So that's what this book is. It's her, you know, journal of that 100 days, and it's really very inspiring, and it's nice, and so it's good to get you motivated to do a long retreat. Because I thought after reading this book, I'm going to do a 100 day. You know, maybe I have to plan for it. But once you start planning for a 100 day retreat, you realize what it involves, like. It involves a lot of money, you know, because that's always a stumbling block for a lot of people. So just think that, well, I can't just leave my family. I'm not in my 20s anymore. I have a family, and they kind of rely on me for income. And so I'd have to save the money to pay for the retreat, because no one's out there offering you a free place to go. You know, even if it's minimal, $50 a day, many places are $75 to $80 a day. So count, divide, or multiply that times 100. And then multiply that times, well, no, my work isn't going to pay for me, so I'd have to take leave of absence. So I'd have to save money in advance to supplement my home money. So it's like, have to, you know, so like a 100-day retreat probably costs around $5,000, just, you know, just for that. So that was kind of a little out of the question. I'd rather go to spend $5,000 and go to Hawaii. And have a nice retreat in Hawaii. So, well, maybe in the future. But, you know, like 10 days by myself and that retreat in the Big Sur was really nice. It was actually 10 days and then I stayed an extra day. And I could have stayed an extra few days, and you know, but I was pretty satisfied with the end of that 10 or 11 day. And so now I'm satisfied with it. If I can get a solitary 1 week kind of, you know, a regular thing, that would take care of a lot of my, you know, these inner needs.
Do you fast? During these retreats, or do you get food?
Get food.
Yeah.
They support you? I mean, they bring you.
It depends on where you go. This year at Sonoma Mountain Zen Center was very disappointing in that. It was disappointing because, you know, like you expect food. If they say they're going to give you food and then the day before you go there, they say, well, you're coming on the weekend and we don't really cook on the weekends. You can have leftovers. and then there weren't much leftovers. So it was kind of like fasting. One of my meals, luckily I didn't need to, but they said you don't have to bring anything. But I did. I brought, you know, a lot of pu'er tea. I brought a bunch of bananas. I brought some walnuts, and I bought a bag of wholesome cookies. And if I didn't do that, I would have been fasting. So some of my meals, I was able to get in, get a peanut butter sandwich, come back to my cabin with it. And so some of my meals, I had an apple. No, it wasn't even like one meal, just a peanut butter sandwich and tea. And then another time I had a tea, apple, and a cookie. That was my meal. And there's nothing in between. So it was kind of a little austerities there. And I kind of like, you know, when you're on retreat, you're in a different mindset. So that's perfectly fine. It's only later that you get a little annoyed with it, you know. But when you're in it, you know, as long as you're not, you know, like having a real need for the food, it was kind of like, oh, well, this is what I'm doing right now. Uh-huh. And then there were meals that I had with them. But I'm not into the fast, going on a fasting retreat, because then that would be the focus of the retreat. And that's not what I'm into right now. Because I, you know, I want the food to nourish me so that I could do my practice. And I don't want the food as the issue. Just want the food at the time that I'm supposed to have it, so that that food doesn't become the issue. But let me say, I just want to read a few little sections from that I pointed out, like reason for retreat. You know, that she doesn't clearly say. I have to like really search and dig and like sort of stretch the point, like for why she's. What she says is her reason for a retreat. I mean, it's throughout the whole book. It's like obvious, but when you're trying to make a point, you can't just read like pages and pages to make the point. When you are thirsty, no explanation in the world will quench your thirst like a glass of water. Similarly, when you embark on a spiritual journey, you have to taste it for yourself, or it will never become yours. If it isn't yours, then it's never there when you really need it. So, like, when you have that quest to go on a spiritual journey or a retreat, there's no amount of thinking about it, reading about it, you know, trying to get an hour here, an hour there, and call that a retreat. You have to go on the retreat. She had to do this 100-day retreat. it wasn't a 30-day retreat or, you know, 60, 50. It was, she had to do a 100-day retreat. Then towards the end, when she's experiencing some nice things, towards the end of the her time there, one of the main purposes of my coming here was to get my mind and body in the same place at the same time. More than 3 months into this adventure, so that's like, you know, 90 days, it's happening more frequently, certainly more so than when I first arrived. By making my focus smaller and smaller, everything is getting bigger and bigger. Just rinsing out the breakfast dishes, I am happy. There's a vast space around things in which anything is possible. A sense of rapture permeates even the smallest activities of the day. So that's, you can experience that on a weekend retreat or a week retreat or a 10-day retreat where, oh, I'm having a cookie and an apple and that's my dinner. You know, you could be really happy with that. You lay it out and like, oh, this is my dinner. And while I'm having my dinner, there's rain, you know, coming down. Or you know, it's the afternoon time and I'm sitting at the desk and everything is so wet and so damp that the moss and the fungus is sort of like 3 inches deep in their woods there. And you know, I took some pictures. When I look at the pictures, it just looks like it's snow all over the place. But it's just, you know, the forest is, you know, when it rains, you know, for weeks and weeks and it's in the woods, it looks very different, you know. And you just, you know, you're just there with that. And so it's, you know, what they say, it's enjoying the simple things without, you don't need anything extra. You don't even need big religious, spiritual experiences. It's just, you know, stopping and listening to the stuff, you know, that's happening all around, and there's nothing else needed. And then towards the end of the book, towards the end of her retreat, this chance to live with the wind and the pines for 100 glorious days and nights, to watch the interplay of form and light without interruption, to find happiness in the taste of barley tea, and to feel at home with myself just the way I am. It was hard won, and no doubt it will be hard to come by in the future. Every day we breathe fresh air. We see brilliant colors and smell 1,000 smells. We hear the sounds of nature, rain, wind, birds, singing, branches creaking, leaves blowing, thunder, dawn. We hear the sounds of humanity, the din of traffic, a train's whistle, children playing in the afternoon. We think somehow it will always be ours for the taking, but we must keep in mind that each experience we have is very precious. It is said that each moment of life is a chance that only comes along once every 500 years. We must live our lives accordingly, with every fiber of respect and attention we can muster. We will not have the chance to do it again. So that's kind of like, well, that's the value of retreat. You know, we kind of miss these opportunities, and we have to go away into a different setting to get back to that very basic living again. And then we can, you know, we can experience those simple things on retreat, but then when we go back to our lives or whatever that is, then we can still, that will continue to happen. We'll then appreciate these things, you know, a lot more than before. And you know, if, you know, I just know that before I did this last January retreat, I was like cranky, irritable with everybody, and tired of teaching my classes. I just needed a break. You know, and yet, you know, you get, you know, what we call burned out. You know, you get stressed out. No matter what you're doing, you get you're doing it so much, and you're giving, and even though there's a lot of it you're really enjoying, and you know, no one's forcing you to do a lot of stuff that we do, but we need to get away, take a separate kind of life experience, get renewed, you know, recharged, and then come back, and you know, right probably where we were, but we, you know, we appreciate it again, and we give more when we, you know, we come back, you know, with you know the fresh eyes again. And then I think the last thing is right her end of the retreat. 24. Yeah, this is the very end of the retreat for her. To think that in a few short hours someone will be coming to pick me up, well, it's kind of thrilling. I'll see all the people I love. I will have access to food, running water, a hot bath. See, you got to read the book to understand, you know, what she says. Running water, a hot bath, clean clothes. But my overwhelming emotion is sadness. All too soon, the machinations of the world and its demands to speak, produce, declare, pay, do, and act will take their toll upon the simple person standing here this morning. In no time flat, I'll be running around, going to work, going to the movies, getting stressed out, and talking all day long about sheer nonsense. I could almost cry, but the practice won't let me. I will miss the incense curling around the Buddha's head in the afternoon light, the silver birches, the mountain laurels, and all the smells and sounds of nature. I'll miss making fires and living simple, the silence and the peace of it all. Thanks to all of it, thanks to Buddha, thanks to my teachers, both living and dead. I promise to never, ever lose this pure mind. I promise to continue for 10,000 years. The bright red of a car appears outside the window. The engine sputters off. Keys are jingling. My friend is walking toward the cabin. It's time to go home. So it's a good, very good book. You know, there's a few copies there. So who's been on like a significant retreat or any kind of retreat? any retreatants?
I have a retreat center, so I came here to kind of get in.
Oh yeah, I met you the last time. I think I
did.
I thought, or maybe I came to one of your talks. You're in Occidental?
I'm in Geyserville.
Geyserville. What's the name of
Isis it? Oasis Sanctuary.
Oh. Yeah.
Isis Oasis.
It's a goddess retreat place. Which are, you know, there are very few of those. There are more Buddhist retreats and things of that nature. But we have a goddess place.
Nice.
So I was interested in what you had to say. And I was wishing that people would come for more quiet, you know, meditative retreats. And would like to put that out so people can do that.
Yeah, well, there's a big need for it, you know. And it's people that have these, you know, have the owners of these properties that develop into retreat centers, you know, they have this, you know, make it available, but I just feel too much they're doing it to make a profit out of it. You know, you can look at some of the costs that it costs to go away. You might as well go to a nice hotel instead of spending the same amount of money and living with all of these austerities. you have to make it affordable, because, you know, the people that really want to go on retreats are like everyday ordinary people that are counting their monies and have to be very frugal with how they spend it, especially now. But they still want to go on retreat, and you know, it's too many retreat places are, you know, pretty expensive. That's why to go on a 100-day retreat, you know, you got to have the resources to save up for that.
In the past, there were these transcendental meditation retreats that were evidently didn't cost any money.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been on one, but I'm a nonprofit, and actually we don't make any money.
Yeah.
But
yeah, well, like a lot of my early experiences were pretty affordable. I wasn't making much money, or, you know, I was a student, and, you know, I was able to do all of these retreats. You know, to go away, you spend $100, $150 for a week with everything included. I mean, that's probably what I was spending at that time. Because I didn't have money, you know, to spend $1,000 on a retreat. Even these Qigong guys that are offering trainings and retreats, like $3,000 for a week, or you know, $1,200 for a weekend, and so it could get very expensive.
Back in the '60s, Tassajara, I don't know if it's still the case, but if you're a student, they would. It was like $5 or something.
Mm-hmm.
For an overnight, and you got to eat their diet, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
They made their own bread, and then they had these incredible hot springs.
Yeah, I've been there.
Oh, you have been.
Yeah, so it used to be, I mean, but like, you know, Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, like, I'm paying $75 a night for no food. So, you know, but you know, when I went to the Big Sur there, it was $75 a night. They gave me a little break at the end. You know, I had the money saved, but when they weren't used to having people spend like 10 days there, so I gave them paid $700, and he said, well, you could have made it less. You know, they could have give what you wanted. But
is that the call to leave?
Yeah.
Oh.
And but you know, going to these like official retreat centers that are part of Catholic monasteries or other kind of I mean, they still are the best deal for money wise, and they're set up for that, and you don't have to be, you know, practicing that path, you know, because they're open. They want you to, you know, do what Merton said, have an experience on retreat somewhere.
And you don't have to get up and go to Mass at 6 a.m. every day or something?
Uh-uh.
When you went to the big Sur retreat, what kind of structure did they provide? What did you participate in? What did you do on your own?
I didn't have to do anything with them. But I chose to use part of what they offered as some of my structure. Their first service early in the morning, their Vespers. Went to that.
Mass.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Vespers at the end of the day. So that was like around 6:30. So I went to that, and then I went to Vespers in the evening around 5:30 or 6. I went to their Mass a couple of times. But that was mainly the only times I went to the church. And they had a setup where they had where the retreat cabins were, or these houses were, where then they had a kitchen there, and they brought the food there, and then you just go there and fill up your tray and bring it back to your cabin. Or the first week I was in like these trailer homes. So every person had their own trailer home. Then the second week, they had their individual cabins all linked together. And so then I was closer to where the food was. So I was in these two places. But really, you do whatever you want to do. So I went there in January and the weather was great. You know, 2 days it rained a little bit. So I went on these really long walks overlooking the ocean there and had a really nice time there. And then I would come back to the cabin, go to the church. It was a really very primitive church. And so it was nice to go there and meditate. They had a half-hour meditation time after the Vespers, so it was nice. But I want to... Time is probably going by, but... here I'm going to read some of my the retreat that I just did at the Sonoma Mountains, I kept a pretty extensive frequent writing in a journal. So this also gets to the value of retreat. I arrived at the Zen Center at 4:30 in the afternoon. After checking in with Gosha, I emptied the car of all my things. After unpacking, I rearranged the room and sat down to officially start the retreat. It was slightly after 6 p.m. 7:45 p.m. What is the value of retreat? I'm only asking that because I knew I'm coming here. I wouldn't be asking that to myself if I wasn't coming here. So, drinking, so my answer, here's the value of retreat. Drinking a fresh cup of pu'er tea with a homemade chocolate chip cookie. Sunday, 9:15 a.m. Reciting scriptures. I've had my breakfast, made the bed. Some things just don't change. You get it? Breakfast, making the bed. You do that even on retreat. 12:12 p.m. Sitting in my cabin now, writing and listening to the rain on the tin roof. Leafless trees surround the cabin. Many of them are covered in a rich green moss. I sit quietly and listen. There is a silence beneath the surface of the rain. I have to stop my writing to hear it. That's the value of retreat. You know, having these experiences where you're kind of like going beyond the surface of things, listening to the silence beneath the surface of the rain, stopping your writing to listen to that. That's why you do retreat. 1 p.m. I'm having a simple lunch in my cabin. It looks like there was some kind of lunch meeting in the main house and kitchen. I am having a fresh cup of pu'er tea with it. It feels so good, that warm, mellow flavor. 1:30 p.m. Taoist Mysteries and Magic by John Blofeld, page 122. Stillness in the heart of movement is the secret of all power. So that's just a quote. This is 6 p.m. that Sunday night. What is the value of retreat? The answer is becoming clearer as my busy thinking mind calms down a little and it steps aside to allow insights to emerge. And that is the value of retreat, to allow the insight mind to come forth. The Nenya, which a Taoist scripture, would say that the heart mind within the heart mind can come forth through the quieting practices of retreat. Challenge of retreat. I sense one of the things this passage, there was a quote that I was referring to, this passage addresses is that when one is on retreat, there are still temptations to distract us. We can go to a beautiful retreat center or some kind of cabin and simply enjoy ourselves to no end by just being in nature. We can spend all day hiking in the woods or walking on the beaches and feel really refreshed and relaxed. But have we served our purpose of going within, of quieting the sense stores and returning to tranquility, which is not influenced by likes, dislikes, beauty, or ugliness? Are we still not stuck in the dualities of heaven and earth? And chapter 27 of the Tao Te Ching comes to mind. Without going out your door, you can know the whole world. Without looking out your window, you can know the way of heaven. Sages therefore know without traveling, name or understand without seeing, and succeed without trying. That's kind of like what this Jain realized after she went all the way over to Tibet to find this one particular teacher, that he was probably just a few hundred miles. Well, yeah, she was in Boston and he was in New York. It was a 4-hour train trip. So that's why this part, this one of the chapter from this the Tao Te Ching, without going out your door, you know, like sitting there at your table or in a chair in your cabin. You don't have to go, you know, I learned that myself. I didn't have to go to India to find God. God was, you know, right here. You know, I didn't have to go get really sick and close to dying, you know, what I did when I was, you know, right before I went to the Vedanta Monastery. I had just returned from India. Got really sick, was really disillusioned with who I went there with. So I didn't have to do that. I could have stayed back here in good old, you know, United States of America. But I needed to do that. It's sort of like I needed to taste that. I probably would have been very unsettled if I didn't do that. So I had to do that. I had to taste that myself. I couldn't just go on what other people were saying. Okay, back 3:20 p.m. Just returned from the yard where I had a good circle walking Qigong. And I just made a fresh cup of brick pu'er tea. It is a young tea, but my tea supplier says the leaves are potent because the trees are very old and they have a lot of qi. Hold it a minute, talking to myself. Let me taste this cup. So I'm drinking my tea. Ah, very nice pu'er. Just what I needed on this rainy afternoon again. Do a retreat. Here I am talking, because, you know, I got this other agenda while I was kind of writing this. I have a couple of students that I'm kind of writing this to, you know, people that are doing this thing. Say, part of my program that I have for students is they have to do retreats. And some of them are saying, oh, I'm always going off into the woods. I went hiking in the woods and, you know, my wife came and I'm always, you know, going and doing this and really loving being in the woods. And that's all fine, but it's sort of like, well, is that the retreat that you know, part of this training? Or is it just like really having a nice experience going off in the woods? So, you know, there's a difference there that you may come away from, you know, because of the potential for distractions. Like, you could go off in the woods, like, for a year and have a real retreat experience. But if you go off for the woods in a very, you know, a couple of days, you're probably just enjoying being in the woods, you know, getting away from the work and really being in the woods and refreshing. But is that the, you know, is that a retreat? So here I am kind of like saying, do a retreat. Walk in the great woods, the beautiful beaches, but don't stop there. Go deeply into not to. That's one of our spiritual koans in our path. Go deeply into not to until you see directly all these objects of perceptions as manifestations of the formless Tao. Let your awareness be free from any limitations of the small mind, so you may perceive the heart of our being. Let the beauty of nature draw you in, but don't stop prematurely, lest you miss the way of heaven and earth. 2, I don't have the time, maybe it's early in the morning. What is the way of tea? What is the way of tea? Let the tea cool down so that when you drink it, the lips and mouth don't have to jerk back from the heat. This way, when the tea enters the mouth, it is in harmony with you already. That's the end. Oh, I think that was the end. Okay, so I'm done. You've caught up with my retreat. Any more questions or comments? Or
Did you get different things out of retreats by being in different religious environments? For example, the Catholic environment versus the Vipassana versus you know, the Taoist retreat, and so on. Did you get a different feel from that, or?
Well, you know, there's the surface thing that's different. Even you know, if they're different Taoist you know places or Buddhist, you know, retreats, but every place is different. But there's always a continuity. There's what you need to learn, you know, what area you're growing in. You know, like, I've done the same, very similar kind of meditation in all of these different retreat centers. And I've learned, like, that first thing that I did with Kriya Yoga, within a very short time after that, I knew Kriya Yoga was not for me. I mean, that was really clear. That was a kind of a practice that was, at the time, and I still, well, I'm not sure what I feel now, but at the time it was a very strong, powerful meditation practice that as a young 20-something-year-old person, I was not ready for. And that literally shook the foundations of, you know, myself at a very deep level. And that was even, like, I did this with the Self-Realization Fellowship. I had to do a year, like, a correspondence course with them, like, weekly lessons I got. And then that only got me to, like, this so-hum kind of meditation initiation. And then when I had this Kriya initiation with Roy Eugene Davis, that was too much of a thing that I wasn't ready for. So aside from that experience, all these other retreats were continuing to, you know, obviously learn about myself, but learn about myself in connection to the rest of the universe. And so for the most part, you know, I'm still reflecting on many of these retreats, and I'm still writing about them. Some of these strong experiences that I write about now were like from, I can name the retreats that I had, you know, these Buddhist retreats, these Catholic monastery kind of, you know, retreats. Some of my real key experiences happened all these different settings, but they are still very much of what I'm doing now. You know, so it's not every place. But, you know, so in a way it didn't matter because I'm still bringing myself to those retreats and, you know, still the process that I was going through.
So the difference between when you went to Big Sur and then the next year when you went to the Zen Center, the one was Catholic, right? And the other was...
Yeah, but I wasn't doing a Catholic retreat.
Right. I understand that. You were looking for solitude.
Yeah.
And they were affording it. Besides the fact of the food issue, and it raining every day, which had to be a little different. Did it make a difference in how you reacted to the silence, do you think?
Or I love the silence. And there,
But I mean, it didn't matter whether you were in a Catholic monastery or whether
I have it. I didn't read it in my notes here. I saw a lot of people that. A lot of the things that I did, I know a lot of people can't do, because I've seen that in very, you know, concrete examples. I saw, and I was at the Christ in the Desert Monastery in New Mexico I went 2 times for 2 weeks, and then I went a third time for a 3-month stay. And it's a beautiful place, and I went there when it was still very, kind of maybe just 10 years old, and they still didn't even have electricity when I went there. And they had a room that was a Thomas Merton room. When I was there during one of the summers, when it was really nice and really beautiful, I remember I was like doing some work during the day, and I was hanging out at the guest house, and I see some guy, you know, just like the corner of the eye, I see another retreatant come in, settle into his room, and I thought, I'll meet him later, you know. And then I saw him go for a little walk looking down into the river that was there. And then I didn't see him after that. And I said to one of the monks there, I said, what happened to that guy that just showed up? And they, because they were familiar with this phenomena, they said the silence drove this guy out. And that's why a lot of people don't go on retreats, because of the silence. You know, the woods could be pretty noisy, you know, with all the animals and the wind. But there is still a lot of silence there. But you go to a desert that is 100 miles away from Santa Fe, 25 miles into the desert from the closest little town, Abiquiu. And there's like 10 people living there. The desert is very quiet. You could hear the sound of the the silence. It's like pounding. And they said they've had a lot of people come there for, you know, and it's not even a commitment to like be a monk and live there. It's like for a week or 2 weeks. A lot of people can't take that overwhelming silence. And so, you know, that becomes an issue for a lot of people. They think they want the silence, and most people do want it and have a good experience, but occasionally that silence will screen you out, and it'll push you out. But, I mean, that's, Big Sur was, it was pretty silent there, but, you know, and you can see the ocean, but you can't hear anything because it's pretty high up in the hills, so you're not hearing the roar of the ocean, you know, the constant sound. And I was just there at a very nice time. There was no heavy winds, and so there was a lot of silence there. You know, probably me walking by myself along their driveway was making more noise than the surrounding, you know, noise coming from, you know, nature there.
So. These people need a probably go through withdrawals because of the they need an electronic. Kind of slowly detached.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Cell phones, laptops, television, radio.
Oh yeah.
Noise from traffic. And
yeah.
Airplane.
You mean I spend a lot of time thinking. You know, I come back and I talk to Jim after some of those things about how all of these things that we are accumulating at a very, it's like accelerating. You know, like, you know, it used to just be the cell phones. Now it's all the things we could do with cell phones, and then all the things we can plug into our ears, and you know, it's just, and then the games, you know, kids and, you know, it's adults and it's everybody, that it's so distracting of, you know, what we're doing to ourselves. And, you know, if